You can't rely on blind faith to get the pregnancy support you deserve. Ritual's Essential Prenatal Multivitamin is the only leading prenatal backed by its own human clinical trial. Essential Prenatal is proven to deliver key nutrients, including folate, biotin, and vitamin D during pregnancy. Get 25% off when you visit ritual.com/clinical. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hi, I'm Devin Whitmire. People from South Carolina, like myself, are proud of their state, but even we don't know every nook and cranny or every piece of culture or history. To explore places that are off the beaten path, you have to talk to the people there, because their stories, their ideas, make everything come together. From Discover South Carolina, it's the Palmetto Porch. To learn more, visit scpalmettoporch.com.
I'm Dan.
And I'm Alex, and welcome back, guys, to On Air. Pleased to have you here. Happy Wednesday. How are you, Dan?
I am good. I'm so excited as we near summer, where, you know, there's always fun stuff going on in the industry. And I'm mostly just curious how you're doing, Alex.
All is well. There's been a lot on, and also it's that rush, isn't it, that people are trying to do things, as you say, with summer on the horizon. I also think in the aviation calendar, it's a bit different, because this year is a Paris year in terms of the big air show of the year, not a Farnborough year. And because Paris happens in June, whereas Farnborough happens at the end, typically, of July, I feel that calendar brings summer much closer, with airlines wanting to get as much as they can done before they either kind of show it off at Paris or they sign the deals at Paris and so on. So yeah, it does suddenly feel crazy that, wow, we are basically in the middle of the year already.
Isn't it funny that Paris, you or the air shows in general, didn't used to be a time for airlines to show off their products to the public. It was more of an industry event. But somehow, since COVID especially, I feel, air shows have also become opportunities for airlines to market themselves to customers, to reveal new products, instead of just placing massive orders, right?
No, you're absolutely right. And also, I mean, the importance of the biggest air shows, Farnborough and Paris, really, they are in another league compared with the other air shows that occur around the world. And not only do you have massive aircraft orders there, but because there is so much attention globally focused on what happens, even announcements that would otherwise get no media attention if it was just a press release on an ordinary week get that attention during Paris and Farnborough. So that's why in these weeks, it goes very quiet on the aircraft order side. We're not hearing much from Airbus or Boeing. There is still a question mark as to whether or not Boeing will be exhibiting in with their 777X or the 737 MAX as they used to years ago before everything got a bit more complicated for the leadership there. So it is, yeah, it's aviation under a microscope, I guess, is the way to look at it. But and
that
we
actually
will be with everyone.
That makes me think about the order that Qatar Airways placed recently, that Trump was saying that was the biggest Boeing order in history, but it was in fact the biggest 787 order and some others. But when will we find out the biggest wide body order
in Boeing's history.
When will we find out the specifics of that? Because obviously that was timed to coincide with Trump's visit, but there's always, like, sometimes you announce an order, but we still don't know the details of what exact type of 787s, for example, that they've decided to order, right? Or what the breakdown is, the delivery dates, that kind of thing.
So the breakdown is there, but they haven't gone specific to variant. And I think that's because they're going to stay flexible in terms of what's available when. And I guess that's just how the world has changed now. You know, you and I used to sit at these aircraft order announcements when we were 14, 15 years old. And the airline in question would then receive those aircraft about 2 years later. And it was kind of, you know, it was a headline if it was 3 months late, and there would be anger on the airline side or with the supplier and so on. And also, we would have immense clarity on the exact variants and what was arriving first and so on, because everything was just so much more textbook. Now, that's not the case now. So I think this is just another example of an airline having to stay agile and not commenting too specifically on variants, because if it turns out, for example, that they are ordering the Dash 9s and the Dash 10s as we expect, and perhaps there are more Dash 9s available sooner, perhaps they are available earlier in terms of being able to provide capacity for peak seasons like Christmas or summer or whichever year these deliveries occur in, then that's how they're probably going to order these to the timeline of their deliveries. Second to that is, of course, there is a question mark on deliveries themselves. There are no supplier, either Airbus or Boeing, is able to actually commit and stick to that commitment right now on almost any aircraft program globally. That is quite an unprecedented place to be in, at least if you told us that about 8 years ago. But that's the reality of where we are. The suppliers are struggling. There's a supply chain crisis. There are tariffs to add complications. There is global uncertainty over the risks of something like a recession. And all of this plays a role into whether or not an airline is going to get an aircraft on time, or what even on time means these days. So yeah, that's why I think we haven't had that breakdown.
That's interesting. So then how would an airline go about ordering seats? Because in my mind, if they're just going to say, all right, we'll grab some Dash 10s because those are more readily available, we're having equally lengthy delays with getting seats delivered in quantities necessary for aircraft. Would they just fill up a warehouse of seats even beforehand and then they put the necessary number, you know, for that aircraft?
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, I guess the funny part is that the delivery of seats is also delayed because everyone's struggling with the supply chain, and there is a lot of commonality between the suppliers. But there are airlines that I know of that are taking delivery of seats before aircraft because the aircraft are late. This is on the single aisle side. And so what's happening is these seats are going into the maintenance facilities, the MROs, the hangars, and they're there until the aircraft arrive, and then they're being installed later at the airline's hub, rather than being delivered to the manufacturer, for example, in this case to Airbus, to be installed as part of the final delivery. So it's just everyone having to meet the adjusted timelines of each other. And there are so many stakeholders involved in all of this. And look at the new Q suite. I mean, I know that you were in Dubai, so you got some good close-ups of Q suite next gen. That aircraft, according to the CEO, that cabin is supposed to launch on the 777X. But with a big question mark over whether or not the 777X will be able to be on time in its delayed schedule, which is, we're now looking at the end of 26, then Q-Suite Next Gen is set to now launch on the A350, because it seems that that will be ready further. And they can't just hoard up these brand new suites in the hangar in Doha. And many airlines, I think, are finding themselves in this position. And so we're going to see more of this.
Yeah. I mean, I think the most important thing for all passengers is just getting the newest seats on planes quickly. And sometimes, I mean, it's like we see with Lufthansa, the complexity of Allegris is just causing so many issues. And it's like people don't necessarily even want Allegris. They just want a new, better seat. It doesn't have to be the best, just a step up from what they currently have. And that's the problem, that they're not going for the best, but they're also going too complicated. But then, you know, of course, Emirates' new business class seats, they're not industry leading in any way, but at least it's a simple enough seat that they're getting them in such huge quantities that they're turning around two aircraft three aircraft a month basically are being reconfigured. So they're going snap, because they have availability of a seat that isn't too crazy kind of thing. So, it would be interesting with United, for example, with their new Polaris to see how that goes.
Yeah. It's such a complicated time for all of the players in aviation that it's a miracle we haven't seen. I mean, it's a miracle everyone is on the whole doing well in terms of their profits, because if we were in one of these cycles in aviation now where we were losing airlines, and you remember we went through that before the pandemic, but 2018, 2019, we lost a ton of airlines.
Yeah.
They just were not financially fit enough to survive. I think if you combine that with the economic uncertainty and the tariffs and all the supply chain crisis, the delivery delays and everything now, you will just have the perfect storm. So it's a difficult industry to crack, the airline business. No one is doubting that. And I think that's a nice segue actually into what we want to discuss.
Yes. Good segue indeed. So today we wanted to do a little bit of a deep dive now that we have had the four first and possibly only flights of global airlines out of the way. So they had one round trip from Glasgow to New York and one from Manchester to New York. And we wanted to wait a little bit until we had seen all the reports, read all the articles, yeah, YouTube videos to form our distant opinion about what is going on here, because it's hard to figure out. I think even for the people on board, it was hard to figure out what is this, aiming to be compared to what they promised. And there's a lot to say.
Yeah, you're right. So global airlines is something that we've mentioned before. It's being pioneered by a British guy called James, who has this idea to bring back the golden age of air travel with a fleet of A380s and operating on premium routes like to New York. What has actually come about today is not really in line with that. It's an airline without an AOC, and it's operating in partnership with HiFly. So HiFly is actually operating the flights for Global. And HiFly is a Portuguese wet lease airline that usually runs to the rescue when airlines have mega delays and need an aircraft quickly, when they are short of aircraft, when they have strike action, when you have rescue flights and so on. HiFly are the ones that you call to step in for these kind of temporary leasing. And wet lease in aviation means that it's not just the dry lease, which would be just the aircraft itself, but wet lease means that it's coming typically in an ACMI capacity. So that's the aircraft, the crew, the maintenance, and insurance. With the global scenario, Global had this massive plan to take on BA, take on Virgin, and perhaps that is still the plan. But what is Global today is something that is quite different to that original plan. And as you said, Dan, we wanted to first see how these first four flights go to form an opinion from a distance. Neither Dan nor myself were on the flight, we should be really clear, but we have assessed all of the footage, all of the videos, the YouTubers that have been on the flight, but also the articles, the more traditional print media that were there, and then all of the discussion points around it to form this discussion. What has been your initial takeaway so far of Global, which I know, by the way, many of the listeners have written into us. We've had dozens of messages asking us to discuss this and to give our take on this. So we thought we'll dedicate this episode to do so. So yeah, going back to my question, sorry, Dan, what was your, what's been your main takeaway so far?
Well, first of all, we should say that although the fact that they don't have an AOC basically means that they're not quite an airline. It's more of an airline brand that is being serviced by HiFly. But that said, whatever the experience was like on the first flight or the subsequent flights, it is incredibly impressive that basically one individual with an idea or a couple of individuals with an idea and a dream could get this far in such a tough industry. Getting to a point where you're operating a transatlantic A380 flight is crazy. And I think if you and I were, you know, facing that task, it would be too daunting to even, you know, take a crack at. So I think we have to say that
the fact it's an A380 is the biggest, I guess, achievement on that side of all, to charter an aircraft and then to sell tickets for that charter flight, doable. But to take an A380 out of the desert, restore it into operation, and then get it cleared to operate those transatlantic flights with passengers on, that's not an easy job by any means. So that definitely does deserve recognition. You're right.
Exactly. And I think that I've never met James, and I don't know what type of people are behind this, but even if this is one of those things where you just want to prove the doubters wrong, like they were so desperate to prove that they could do it that they went through with it. Even if that's the case, kudos to them, because the fact they managed to go this far, it is impressive. Of course, they had some very lofty goals that perhaps they didn't quite fulfill. And I think that, you know, one of the most striking things that everyone has seen from the first flight was that interview, which you actually sent me. Do you want to explain what that was? Because you know the context as a Brit.
Sure. So this was this, I mean, we're looking at this project, just to be clear, there is no schedule now for flights. So they're not operating scheduled flights. There is no weekly service, for example, to New York. The charter routes that they had flown with the wet lease agreement with HiFly were between Glasgow and JFK and Manchester and JFK. Four flights in total, they're now complete. There is no word now on what is next. Is the plan to actually obtain an AOC and become an airline standing on its own two feet? Is the plan simply to have kind of a branded partnership with HiFly, whereby now HiFly do as they always did in their own business model as a wet lease carrier, but under a brand that is a UK airline brand known as Global? And so does that mean that the service elements that the founder wants to be associated with Global now appear on every HiFly flight going forward if it's on the A380? Remember, there's just one aircraft here. It's just the one A380. There are dozens and dozens of question marks. It all remains really unclear. And to answer your point specifically, the British TV network Talk, which are now, I think they're now fully online, they're no longer on regular TV. Talk were a TV and radio network. They were interviewing the travel editor at The Independent, who was on the flight, and he was at the airport, and his name is Simon, and he was being interviewed by Talk. And he was, of course, incredibly skeptical. He was kind of painting the picture in that they have one aircraft, that there is no digitalization yet in terms of, you know, being able to access your booking or manage different elements of your itinerary or things like that, that the tickets were sold by a specific travel agency only, and you had to contact them, and they were, I think, were in Slough in the UK. Just kind of painting a picture of it being very, very different to what was potentially or what was previously advertised. During his interview, the founder walked over and he said to him, "Hey, you know," and kind of greeted him a bit sarcastically, we noted. And he said to the travel editor at The Independent, "You know, oh, you were one of those that said we would never be here. And here we are now, you know, in the check-in hall, ticketing and ready for departure on this A380. Simon, the travel editor at The Independent, asked the question, which everyone is wondering, which is, what next? You have these four charter flights, but what next? Is this the introduction of a new UK airline? Is this the introduction of competition on the transatlantic route? The exchange was bizarre because the founder, James, seemed to suggest that nobody knows what's next. He kind of said, who knows? And then he said, maybe the aircraft will be used as a spa. Which was
sounds
odd.
Awesome, but maybe not in line with their goals.
No, I mean, I take it with a pinch of salt, right? He was being sarcastic, but was he? I don't know. I mean, it was a funny exchange. Maybe we should put the interview in the description so that the listeners and the viewers can go on and be the judge of this themselves. But I was hoping in that scenario, we would be able to hear what the plans were beyond these four flights that have now concluded. But there isn't. And the skeptical side of me wonders if this is because there was an obligation. And I think I told you this, right? Is it that they were obligated to get four flights under the Global brand airborne in order to contractually comply with XYZ terms with whoever is funding this project? Or was it because they wanted to, you know, gain experience and give passengers experience for the first time while they learn and they kind of like crew familiarization flights? One thing I noted, Dan, that was never mentioned. I've triple checked. It was never mentioned that these flights were crew familiarization in preparation for their hard launch in Q3 25, for example. That wasn't the thing. It was, so seeing this bizarre exchange, I don't think instills much confidence into travelers who are wondering, you know, if this is actually an airline brand that they should take seriously. The presenter of Talk was just absolutely staggered. He's a presenter named Mike Graham. He couldn't understand what he saw this exchange and this bizarre answer, and he then encouraged Simon at the Independent to not board this flight. He said, it's not safe. You shouldn't go. This is amateur. This is insane. So I don't know if that did, the whole concept any favors. What did you think?
I mean, the interview was fascinating. And again, I think that was the beginning. That was before the flight even took off.
And before the first flight.
Exactly. So everything on the first flight, understandably, felt a little bit chaotic because there hadn't been much crew training. So based on what we see from videos, besides the state of the seats, which I think is the most shocking thing, because the seats were not only what was promised, but they looked like they were in pretty terrible shape, and they had these USB chargeable lights on them and all this stuff. But there were all types of problems with the soft product, which I understand on an inaugural flight. And I also heard that apparently Glasgow catering had completely messed up and put meals on the wrong floor, for example. So it caused huge problems for the crew. And on the return flight from New York to Glasgow, everything seemed to be a lot more in order. And it really seemed like they had invested a lot in making the second flight as good as possible. The problem is that the first impression is really what matters. And that was the flight with the most YouTubers and journalists on it. So whatever happened there is sort of what has set the tone. And I understand that maybe a lot of people got free upgrades, or they were maybe invited by the airline. But to those people who actually paid to be on those flights, of course, it didn't really look like it was worth it, to say the least.
No, yeah. They were on an aircraft that was showing its age, that was tatty. The upholstery was done in a pretty kind of rubbish way. In for example, the economy class seats, most of these passengers were sitting down and the entire headrests were just falling off over their shoulder and into their laps. The aircraft is full of wear and tear. It is an older aircraft, and there hasn't been the money obviously spent on a nice, clean, not necessarily a full-blown retrofit, but you know, a facelift, if you like, with the existing upholstery. There was damage everywhere. There were kind of amateur stickers on the cabin walls and all of this, which again leads me to wonder, okay, but nobody forced Global to launch this month, or so that we know, right?
And to pour millions of dollars down the drain,
right?
Literally.
Right. Like, I would wonder, I mean, watching, and I watched all the YouTube videos and all the reviews of the flight, I guess my takeaway was I couldn't understand why the whole thing felt incredibly rushed. Yeah. If you were not ready with the upholstery, if you were not ready with the cabin quality, if you were not ready with the logos that were on the cabin walls, the branding, the way in which the carpet was peeling, the dirt that had been there since the aircraft was in storage in the desert, then why did you launch when you did? Because knowing they have built such a big PR case for this airline with the highest of most unrealistic expectations of how we're going to be better than Emirates First Class and we're going to be in another league compared with Singapore and all of this. I mean, you knew that the aircraft and the whole flight experience would be under the microscope versus any other airline on that day. Yeah. And also you knew that the world's YouTubers would flock to such an opportunity in order to, and this is now everywhere with millions of views. I just wonder why the rush. And I say that because the founder is an incredibly well-traveled man. He, I think, was the youngest person to visit every single country on earth. I don't know if that, I think that record has now been overtaken by someone else, but categorically that record was his, right? At one time. With that, he has flown extensively. So he knows what's good and what's not. And so again, I was wondering, with him knowing the standard globally, it's not like this is a guy with no idea of what airlines are doing. He's flown them all. Why would you risk, you know, tarnishing the brand of a startup where there is so much PR involved with such a shoddy first experience? And I put myself in that situation and do the walk around of that aircraft before, and I think the only conclusion would have been that it's not ready, and the service elements are totally separate, and that was definitely not up to scratch. And it was they said that they were starving on the flight because they cancelled the second meal service. They didn't get the first drink until 2 hours in. There wasn't enough catering. Some got bread, some didn't. Some got butter, some got no bread. You know, it was just the whole thing was very, very, very messy, which leads me to believe that there was some kind of pressing, urgent reason as to why they needed to get these four flights airborne when they did. Because from everything I saw, this was not an airline ready to launch.
Yeah. And let's remember, there were only 95 people on the first flight. I can't imagine there were any more on any of the subsequent flights. So
I think it was quieter on that return back from JFK to Glasgow.
For sure. Most of the people, I think, who were on the flight from Glasgow to JFK were not on the return. So I just imagine it was very empty. But the point is that I think the CEO should have been running around making sure that everything was as it should. And I didn't see that in any of the videos. Instead of focusing interviews or whatever, or enjoying the experience, you are the one, as you see sometimes on airlines, which I love when you see the CEO being part of the service. He just happens to be taking a flight. He steps in. I think that should have been the case here. What's going on? How can I help you? Okay, you didn't get your bread. Let me sort that out. All these types of things to try to save it as much as possible.
Do you think that's where that gap is between actually Global isn't an airline, which it's not. Global isn't it doesn't have an AOC. It's not something bookable, but rather they're relying on HiFly to deliver all of this. Do you think that gap means that potentially he's unable to stand over HiFly crew and say, this is what we need from you?
Interesting. Yeah, maybe he's not allowed to do that, or he's not even allowed to partake in the service, which would be incredibly frustrating. So that could be why, because I imagine I know for sure if you and I were CEOs of an airline and it was our first flight, we would not be sitting there chatting to people or whatever. We would be the whole time making sure that everything is as perfect as possible. That's at least what I would do. But there's still so many questions. I wonder.
I mean, why Glasgow? Why was it Glasgow in the first place? What was that about?
And where did the money come from is, of course, a huge question to fund all these flights. Because for sure, someone is losing a ton of money and they're getting no return on their investment. So, and one more thing, which I haven't seen anyone talk about, it seems like a tiny detail, but tell me I'm not the only one who reacted to the state of the wings and the engines. Did you notice?
Crazy. How the first thing I saw. And I'm amazed. Now, don't get me wrong. The state of the wings and the erosion, right, at different areas of the fuselage and of the wings and of the aircraft, definitely will have been within the safe legal limits. But it looked shocking. Yeah. And I'm amazed again that is something that they could have definitely have rectified and fixed prior to the big hard launch. And they didn't. Yep. Why? That just seems an unusual decision to me to not.
And you know how they could have built so much more hype and so much more anticipation would have been if they took this step by step. So for the crew to learn the whole service procedure, why not invite people from all over the world? They pay for their own flights and hotels, of course, but you invite them to come to Glasgow or wherever the aircraft is parked and say, we're going to do a simulated flight on the ground. It's going to be 2 hours. Yeah. You're going to get a free meal so we can practice the service delivery, service flow, preparing the meals and everything like that. We get your feedback and you do things like that in steps so that finally, when the first flight arrives, there's been so much hype of people getting to try different parts of the experience, people getting to be part of shaping what the airline turns into, that then when you take your first flight, the crew feels ready, people know a bit more what to expect, which I think would have been good
in this case.
It wouldn't have, you know, they would have had to pay for the food, the crew, that kind of stuff. But I think it would have been worthwhile instead of all the first reviews saying it was a shit show.
I know. I mean, I do wonder if the fact that there is absolutely, because there is no mention on what now, if, as I say, HyFly have this A380, right? They're operating it. They are the ones delivering.
It's owned by Global, but they're...
It's owned by Global, yeah. But HyFly, yeah, HyFly the operator right now. So with it under their operation, I wonder if what was originally the plan for Global just fades into the background. And we just have HyFly operating A380 wherever it's needed, as is. And it's somehow a HyFly partnership with a brand that is better than HyFly, because HyFly is not known as a brand. So Global becomes the brand. And then it's, you know, are you lucky enough to end up on a Global flight because your airline went bust and then this was the rescue flight to come and get you? I wonder if it becomes like just a branding deal that they can deliver for HyFly, some kind of Global brand, literally Global brand, that HyFly has thus far been unsuccessful at, because most wet lease operators aren't in the business for the fame and the big branding and whatever. Look at Titan Airways in the UK. I mean, they're incredibly sound. They're of sound governance. They're successful. They've got a proven track record, and they're literally incognito. I mean, they prefer that the airlines, the passengers don't know what Titan is. We really have to keep a close eye on it, I think, because it's incredibly unclear as to what the actual plan is. And I do feel that the reason why it's unclear to myself, to yourself, to the wider industry, is because there is that missing kind of piece of the puzzle that we're not being told.
Precisely. And I mean, that, unfortunately, as much as we love the A380 is the issue here, because I know that if you and I were launching a long haul airline in 2025, we would probably go the opposite route. At least I would. I would be looking at the A321LR, XLR for as low an operating cost as possible. As much as we would 100% prefer to be on an A380, it's just not economical. And the smaller you can go, the better. And, you know, we've seen, for example, all business class airlines, which traditionally have never been a successful concept. Now you have La Compagnie, an old favorite of ours, it's not wildly profitable, but it's scraping by because of the fuel efficiency of the A321neo on long haul routes, which if they were operating larger aircraft, no way they would still be in business.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, so when we were discussing, you know, what would in today's scenario, and we've had a couple of questions about this, in today's scenario, what would you launch with? For me, it would be an A321LR. So it's the long range variant of an A321neo. If I had to choose a hub right now, let's say literally my airline is effective tomorrow, I think, and this might surprise you, I would choose Lisbon.
Wow.
And
even though the airport is so slot restricted.
If I was able to obtain the slots necessary to be able to operate, then I think Lisbon would be my hub of choice. And I just think Lisbon has never fully been exploited as it could be in terms of its strategic geographic location. Yeah. With a 321LR, I would operate long, thin, premium routes on a narrow body with the efficiencies of a single aisle aircraft. We're talking East Coast, JFK, Boston, DC, Chicago, but then also Brazil, right? And the South American flow that flows between Portugal and Spain and South America. And then I think having that aircraft being able to perform in the way that it would boost Lisbon as this kind of sound hub to efficiently operate. I would want to operate like a JetBlue based in Lisbon, and serve the East Coast and potentially a little bit further in of the United States and Brazil, given the obvious relationship there between Portugal and Brazil. And then in the downtime to boost aircraft utilization, I would just operate gently to, for example, to London or perhaps to Munich or just a couple of European hubs that would only take, you know, a few hours out of the day to then feed back into the Lisbon hub and then take them on onwards. The Azores potentially is an option as well in terms of just a quick European hop and then back to mm-hmm. boost Lisbon as a hub. So I think that is what my back of the napkin airline plan would be if asked right now, which you have asked me right now.
I would fly with your airline for sure. It's interesting. Good. Obviously transatlantic is very profitable for airlines. It's a good market to be in. I just feel like personally, I'm bullish on the future of Asia and, you know, economic development there. So I think transatlantic is a solid bet. I was thinking that the Middle Eastern carriers still struggle somewhat with the reputation that the Middle East has. There's people that, you know, there's lots of people that fly with them and they're incredibly profitable. But I think that if you could go as close as possible to the Middle East without actually having the negative connotation that some people associate with the Gulf, you might be able to tap into that. So what is the closest spot? Unfortunately, it's not super high yield, which is the problem with my plan. But Athens, I think, is very well geographically located to be a hub somewhat for Europe to Asia and Africa, which is untapped because very close to Istanbul, so similar to Turkish Airlines, but everyone loves Greece. Everyone in Europe loves Greece. It has super positive associations. It's a quick 2 to 3 hour flight for most of Europe. And on an A321 XLR, you could get to all of Africa. You could reach all of India and even the likes of Hanoi, many cities in China, and possibly kind of stretching it, but possibly Bangkok. So you're getting quite far. You go to the Maldives, of course, you go to India, Sri Lanka, the Middle East. This is partly Aegean's model, but I think there's room
for... This is a great plan. This is the plan that Aegean should have been adopting if they were, you know, a little bit braver, because there is a massive gap in the market in Athens, across Greece, for long haul connectivity, for point to point, either by something like an A321 XLR or a 787 Dreamliner. I think with the influx of, you know, all the Americans, you would have the best summer ever. But also there is enough as a European capital that is, as an economy, is doing very well compared with other European capitals, probably because Greece got its financial crisis out the way nice and early, right? I just think that there would be real strength in the capabilities there to connect different hubs through Athens.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it is, Turkish Airlines does well. Athens is so close that they can fly to most of those destinations with economic aircraft. And Greece is one of the most popular destinations in Europe. So they would have the inbound demand to their hub, although it's, again, not the most high yield in Europe. I think it could work. I mean, then again, maybe it's not much lower than the likes of Istanbul and stuff like that. So
I'm just bringing up, on my other screen, range and basically like your destination options. I mean, you're talking, you could connect Athens with Shanghai.
Yeah.
You could connect Athens with Beijing. And this would be incredible, because you're talking high end leisure taking, you know, in this post-pandemic world where China continues to boom. This is luxury inbound tourism. It's the way in which the scenic, you know, beautiful movie-like environment that Greece is home to goes viral on the internet in China. And so taking advantage of that, you could reach South Africa. You could reach Johannesburg. You could tap in a bit closer to home, for example, to Cairo. It's amazing how Athens hasn't been used properly, I think, as a hub.
Exactly. And it's such a good middle point between all of Africa and all of Europe, pretty much. If you think about the biggest carriers to Africa right now, it's Brussels Airlines and Air France, both of which are quite far out of the way from most of Europe, while Athens is a simple flight down, and then you continue in the right direction. Same for the Middle East and Asia. So I think we need to see Athens.
Think about,
and Aegean should be doing this. We need A321s Aegean with live flight seats going to all these types of places, but they're scared.
Well, they say it's coming, don't they? They say that the 321s are coming with lie-flat seats, but there's very few updates on...
I mean, will they fly those? I don't imagine anything exciting.
They're just not brave at all. I mean, they're the opposite of brave. They're not ambitious. They don't strike you as having this plan to be able to develop the Athens hub. And I'm not sure why. I don't know if it's the influence of other airlines. I don't know if it's the influence of the ownership of Athens Airport, you know, with everything with basically being headquartered in Frankfurt. I wonder, I mean, even developing your plan even further, right? You could go as far as you want east, and you could, or southeast rather. So you could go perhaps even beyond Singapore, and you would only need one airline to feed in to catch that flow from Australia. Australia being home to more Greeks than anywhere else in the world outside of Greece itself. So it's it's definitely... And what does Aegean do with Australia now? Nothing. They perceive it to be far too far away.
Yeah.
Yes, they sit within the Star Alliance, but there is no obvious feeder of in Star Alliance, for example. There's no obvious Singapore Airlines link that take the Aussies out of Australia through Singapore and then to Athens. Yes, you can do that. You can do it with Scoot, which is like... But to solidify in a clean, slick, you know, long haul boutique brand, I think we'll put my Lisbon plan on the shelf, and I think I've committed myself to our Athens hub as the Greek on the podcast.
I mean, it's just so tragic because they currently have four A321 LRs on order, which is so little. Nothing. And where I imagine they'll send those maybe to India, to possibly parts of Africa, but I don't see them going to Asia.
Well, I remember reading that they wanted to send it to Saudi Arabia, and I'm thinking, well, you can do that now with your A320. You don't need literally an XLR to do it, or an LR, you know?
And there's also this great potential for branding, because Greece has such a distinct...
Yeah.
When you think of Greece, you hear a specific type of music, you think of a specific type of food, you think of colors. Greece has such a unique brand in the sense that you feel every sense already. So Aegean could so easily incorporate that.
I know.
So much and better than any other airline in Europe.
It's such a Lufthansa style airline operating in vibrant, exotic Greece. And you know, I think they fail at even getting the global awareness of what... Do you know the amount of people when they say to me, oh, I'm going to Greece this summer. Okay, great. Where are you going? Oh, they tell me what island they're going to. Okay, so you're flying via Athens? Yeah. I say to them, who are you flying with? And they say, Aegean have done a terrible job at even educating the world's passengers globally that Aegean is the name of the sea, the Aegean Sea. There's just absolutely no link. You should, as a passenger globally, hear the airline Aegean and immediately picture what the yogurt adverts around the world are successful at depicting, right? You know, that's what Aegean needs to take a leaf out of the yogurt industry, because the yogurt industry has advertised, I mean, they've advertised Greece and beyond. They've done such a successful job at it. And yet all of these yogurt brands are fake yogurts. They're not Greek yogurts. They're full of harmful chemicals that would never appear in an authentic natural Greek yogurt. That's a podcast for another day.
Yeah.
Right.
So,
but it's, that's what they need to take a leaf out of.
If any billionaires are listening to this, call us because we need your money.
In the description
we're
below.
Inspired.
Yeah. We're ready to take, we are ready to make Aegean great again, right? Or even make Aegean. No, Greece is already great. Okay, Greece doesn't need you and your phony Trump-inspired lines.
Sorry,
firstly, we need to make Aegean Greek again. That's and then I guess we'll start from there. Should we dive into Q&A?
Oh, I don't want to leave this topic. It's so fun because we exist so much more. But fine, we'll do
so
it, and we'll continue this another day when we're, you know, we've forgotten about our dreams.
Done.
Let's start with a topic that's related to what we were just talking about. Elizabeth says, have followed you both way before the podcast and love the podcast. More of a question for Dane. Oh, thank you. What are your thoughts on Aegean customers being able to use their miles to redeem on Emirates flights? It's basically using Star Alliance miles to redeem on Emirates. Had to try and could redeem to New York and also found flights to Australia. I've been thinking and saying for years that Emirates will join Star Alliance at some point. Is this the first step? Is it allowing to test the waters here? Would love to hear, well, both of our thoughts. In my opinion, Emirates and Etihad are strongly anti-alliance, especially Emirates. I don't see them ever joining an alliance, but they do have their partners here and there. In this case, it is interesting because they're very restrictive, even with which airlines they allow to use points on, for which partner airlines can redeem on Emirates flights. It is hard. Emirates is a hard one to redeem points on, and I don't see this as anything super promising in the grand scheme of things, unfortunately.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. And as I say, to answer that part, I don't think that it's a sign either that Emirates has taken a step closer to Star Alliance. It's just a very kind of specific partnership on specific routes in a specific area, as Dan highlighted.
Yeah. Paulo asks a question that I think we both think about a lot. He says, I'm Paulo from Portugal. I love the podcast and Dan's videos since the very first one. Well, thank you. I'd like to ask you a question, which I believe you've probably been asked several times before. If airlines like Singapore Airlines, Turkish, and others, mainly Asian carriers, manage to be highly profitable while offering full service on short and medium haul flights, why do we in Europe have to put up with the current economy and business class model with considerably inferior or non-existent service? Couldn't the Asian model work here as well? Thanks for our work.
What well, do we say? I mean, something we've discussed at length, and I would encourage you to go back to episodes that were specifically dedicated to this, but I think we are in a period right now where premium leisure travel continues to be a source of strong income for airlines. And with that, I think it would work. But the reality is this: Europe has demonstrated that without any decent solid premium offering and empty middle seats, they still fill up these aircraft. They're still able to remain incredibly financially agile in terms of adjusting the size of the cabin and therefore the profitability that business class will make on any given flight. And so, unfortunately, it's just the way Europe has become. It continues to make money for the likes of BA, for the likes of Lufthansa, even Air France, KLM. And I don't see it changing unless one of them did, and then everyone flocked to them, and then the others would have to level up, and that's kind of what's happened. They all love the fact that they have each other locked into this arrangement of, right, we're all going to be much worse than the Asian carriers, right? And they're all like, right, you know, and then that's how they then move forward. There is also, of course, the geography of Europe and it catching the flows to and from the Atlantic, the other side of the Atlantic, and east, and feeding across Europe on loads of 1 hour flights here, there and everywhere, they know that it doesn't matter as much. But I would say that that's still not the number one reason. The number one reason is it has been the norm, the status quo for so long. And there isn't going to be anyone that is at the expense of their own finances going to take the hit just to say, look, we're offering you between London and Barcelona a lie flat seat. The other airlines would be like, yeah, good luck with that.
I mean, it is just bizarre because you look at what KLM charges, or KLM and Air France charge for their short haul business. Gothenburg to Amsterdam, which is a 1 hour 30 minute flight. In economy, it's the cheapest ticket is $116 one way.
Okay.
The cheapest business ticket is $708 one way on a 1.5 hour flight. And they are filling that cabin, obviously not with people paying this, but with people connecting and that kind of stuff. But yeah, these prices are bizarre. And clearly they can get away with it because if they had to charge less, because their cabins are empty, they would, but it's working out for them. So true. I think we can also partly blame low-cost airlines, blame Ryanair, EasyJet, because they've set the standard so low for what people expect to pay for things in Europe that, I mean, if you look at an average Singapore Airlines flight in Asia or an average, I mean, forget about the Middle East. If you look at Emirates, Qatar, Etihad, a 1 hour flight will be $2,000 or $3,000 in business. So yes, you're getting amazing service, but you're also paying 3, 4, 5 times more than you would for a similar flight in a part of the world where the service is worse. Yeah. And clearly in Europe, the answer is that no one is going to pay $2,000 or $3,000 for a 1 hour flight, however good it is.
True. Very true. And as I say, it brings us back to that fact that it's just been the norm. You know, what we have now is the norm. And that's why there isn't going to be anyone that will come along and successfully rip that up. Unless things drastically changed and they all then, you know, started to follow a major player. But I don't see that happening.
Yep. So I love this question from Namir because I wonder the same thing. He says, love the podcast and can't wait for it every week. I have a question. I want to know more about your career progression, Alex, to understand what you do now and your current role. Would you be happy to discuss this on the podcast? Thank you, Namir, because I've been wondering this since the first time I met Alex. What exactly do you do?
But we don't have another hour for me to go into it unless we do. Do we?
Two sentences.
All right. Two sentences. So my name is Alex. I'm an aviation consultant. And with that, I also appear as the resident aviation analyst in a broadcast capacity on global TV networks, including across the BBC, in the US, CNN, and several other radio stations dotted around the world globally to provide analysis and commentary on the state of play of international air travel globally. It was a lot of commas, but I still think it was two sentences.
Sure, sure. So next question here from PJ, who says, really enjoy the podcast, been binging the last couple episodes as I missed a few weeks. I have a question about turbulence. I recently flew Abu Dhabi to Singapore in first class on Etihad's A380 and the return flight in their business class. Great experience on Etihad, but both flights were very turbulent. At one point, the crew was asked to be seated for 30 minutes, and we had those moments of momentary levitation. Being a nervous flyer myself, the second relative strong turbulence hits. So he gets nervous when turbulence hits. He's saying, I was hoping to hear from you guys how you cope with it, being frequent flyers.
So, well, look, you and I, let's use the example of the flight that we were on, right? We were on the very similar route coming back from Singapore to Doha, right?
Yep.
How do we cope with it? I mean, neither of us enjoy turbulence. I don't think you enjoy it either, do you?
Actually, I mean, it depends. On an overnight flight, of course, I don't want turbulence. But in a way, in the right time, if you're not eating and you have all these drinks, I think it's kind of cozy to be like bumped around a little bit, because we know for a fact that turbulence cannot down an airplane. And I love this analogy. Yeah, there's this analogy that's been going around TikTok the past few years, which I think is perfect. It's like you're a plane stuck in Jell-O. The Jell-O can bounce, but you can't just sink through the Jell-O because you're hovering in the middle. So it's not possible to just fall out of the sky. You can bounce a bit, but there's always air underneath to catch you, because what happens in air turbulence is an air pocket.
Okay, your quote is scary. I mean, it's like, is it? You're talking, well, to an average person, oh, don't worry, the air below you will catch you. And everyone's like, you mean this air that my hand flies right through now? No air is stopping. Obviously,
well,
we get what you
point,
mean with
right?
wings and wingspan and everything. And the concept of physics and flight. Don't you think it's just more simple to say turbulence may feel like it, but it is not unsafe. It is just uncomfortable.
Yeah. I'm literally never scared during turbulence. The only thing I'm scared of is if I would fly out of my seat and hit my head. I'm never, ever worried that the plane will get damaged or they will crash, because that simply doesn't happen.
No, the worry, as you say, is that it starts while you're standing in the bathroom. That's the worry.
Yeah.
I only have that freak out moment if it means I found myself without my seatbelt on in that moment. The moment my seatbelt is on, I'm okay. It's fine.
Yeah.
Even though I don't enjoy it, and it's not, I do think it's uncomfortable because it is uncomfortable. I find it difficult in heavy turbulence, focusing on the screen, trying to read a book, like even trying to sleep. You know, it's not heavy turbulence is not enjoyable, and the likes that you and I had coming back from Asia, you know, we had a bit of that. I also appreciate it when it's mentioned before, and I think more airlines should keep that up. I mean, Singapore Airlines, when we were flying from Seoul to Singapore, were super extra. They came around and warned us like 10 times about how, oh, there's going to be turbulence
and then
in about
it was
20
nothing.
Minutes. It's going to be in 15 minutes, or we're not going to serve you this because of the turbulence. And it was, then they did the announcement, prepare for the turbulence. And it was just all this thing. And there was nothing. It was beautiful. So, yeah.
Exactly. Here's a nice argument from Toby. He said, last week you mentioned why airlines order the A330. You questioned why. From a customer perspective, especially for those who frequently fly economy, the A330 is always preferable due to the 242 configuration rather than 333 or 343, which I 100% see, I 100% agree with. I think in economy, the A330 can be better. Of course, the windows are smaller. And, you know, Toby acknowledges that in his opinion, he thinks the configuration weighs heavier than better cabin pressure and humidity, which you'll get on the A350 and 787.
Yeah.
So I get it. And sometimes when I, for example, the other day I was flying a route where I was faced with the choice, should I fly an A320, a 777, or an A330 in economy, because it was a 1-hour flight. And of course, then I chose the A330 because I was flying with Oscar and I knew that there would only be two seats by the windows.
Yeah,
so we wouldn't have anyone blocking us.
Yeah, no, definitely. That's there you go. There's a sound argument to choose the A330 over other aircraft. That's for sure. Well, look, we encourage you, as always, to send in your questions to the shared Instagram at On Air with Dan and Alex, and we will bring them up in time for the next episode. If we have missed any of your questions, do feel free to just kind of copy paste and bump it back up, just in case we've missed it. That happens from time to time. Thank you for joining us, as always. And Dan, it's been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure. And let's make Greece happen.
We need to revisit this
airline.
Yeah. This is
we
good.
Do.
Yeah.
It's like good. A dream has been born. And I don't want to be CEO, but I want to be.
I'll be CEO.
Ideator. Yeah, you can be the CEO. I'll just be in the background feeding my ideas to you and making sure we have some legal document that makes sure you have to enforce them. All right. On that note,
okay.
We will see you
Turns out, this requires, with that, we're going to take On Air, Off Air for a continued discussion on this. I'm just going to get my lawyers on the phone. They're here. Wonderful. All right, Dan, we'll see you soon.
See you next week. Bye-bye.
You can't rely on blind faith to get the pregnancy support you deserve. Ritual's Essential Prenatal Multivitamin is the only leading prenatal backed by its own human clinical trial. Essential Prenatal is proven to deliver key nutrients, including folate, biotin, and vitamin D during pregnancy. Get 25% off when you visit ritual.com/clinical. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
If you're looking for legit ways to make extra money, you've got to check out The Side Hustle Show. With hundreds of actionable episodes to choose from, you'll learn what's working now from real people making real money. Like the Utah mom who built a six-figure business playing video games, or the guy earning $3,000 a month renting out mobility scooters. Online or offline, from Amazon to your own hometown, from YouTube to vending machines, The Side Hustle Show has you and your wallet covered. Subscribe to The Side Hustle Show wherever you're listening to this podcast and increase your earning power today.